Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly, and it's hard to believe a whole 7 days have gone by, but there's so much to tell you, like about the Irish opera boom, or the queues that formed outside the one-at-a-time theatre box in Cork City Centre, or how to photograph Bob Marley's dreads, and about the sound of the landscapes of late capitalism. Nicer than you'd think, actually. But we start by dangerously confusing cameras and guns. I shot the sheriff, but I swear I used an SLR. Photographer Eric Luke has a long career in capturing images as a newspaper photographer, back when queuing for use of the darkroom was among the struggles of the profession. On the 6th of July 1980, he was dispatched to Dalymount Park in Dublin to shoot a concert by reggae star Bob Marley, an assignment from which one perfect photo emerged, the singer's eyes closed in reverie, his prodigious dreadlocks exploding around his head. Eric Luke's photography, including that Marley image, is currently on show at the Station House Gallery in Dorky, where Culture File's Louis Scully went to meet the photographer.
My name is Eric Luke. I'm a photographer. I've been a photographer with newspapers for 44 years. I was staff photographer with the Irish Press Group for 17 years. Staff photographer with the Irish Times for 27 years. My proper first camera was called a Praktika, which was the first camera I had, which had interchangeable lenses, and bought that in a chemist shop in Dunleary. I remember they very kindly let me pay it off week by week. It was so expensive to buy. I used to go out with other photographers, and I used to go to a lot of rock bands at night and blag my way in and take pictures and then submit them to the paper the next day. I joined the Irish Press Group in 1973, and it was a different setup then. I just thought it was terribly exciting in the newsroom to see a full newsroom in full flight when a story was breaking. The Evening Press was an enormous newspaper, had six different editions in the afternoon every single day. And so it was, in some ways, a bit like the web now, where it was perpetually changing and you were catching up with it each time. I mean, as soon as they put one issue to bed, they were working on the next one, which was actually going to be on the streets 1 hour later. Extraordinary turnaround and very, very exciting. So I went in there as a runner, and then the following year, I applied for a darkroom position. We had 17 staff photographers. There was 1,600 people in the company. That included drivers, printers, everything. And we had 17 staff photographers. And we'd all jostle each other and compete for space in the paper. And every day we'd wonder who was going to get the front page and who was going to get the best picture and who was going to get the best job. And so, but a great camaraderie as well. Coleman Doyle, a legendary figure, still a great friend of mine, long, long, long retired. He and I worked together. He took me under his wing from day one, and we worked together for many, many years. And he brought me to many things, like particularly to coverage of the North. He used to go to the North an awful lot during the Troubles, and if I was on a weekend off, I would just go along with him and start shooting pictures. And he taught me how to look after myself and what I should do and what I shouldn't do and what I should look for and what I shouldn't look for. He was excellent. Tutor, and yes, indeed, he took me under his wing, and I learned everything from him.
All the way from Trenchtown, Jamaica, Bob Marley, come on!
I often laugh at it because I often think it's a bit like the amount of people that say they were in the GPO for the Rising. The amount of people now that say they were in Dalymount Park, and if they were, there was 100,000 people there. But it sort of became an iconic concert. It was one of these things that was talked about more after the concert than before. We had much more freedom then. You could move around and take pictures from whatever angle you want and photograph the crowd. Nowadays, at gigs and at concerts, everything is controlled. You're usually brought to a place like the sound desk and told it's going to be a telephoto shot from here, or you're brought to the foot of the stage and told it's going to be a wide angle shot from here. And you're told you can do song number four, and you can do the second half of song number six, and the first bit of song number seven. And that's all because the band has already decided that they know what backdrop is going to be like at that stage. In other words, the pictures are totally controlled. At that gig with Bob Marley, Pat Egan would just let you move around.
Sun is shining, the weather is sweet, yeah.
But I do remember it being a very, very sunny day, a beautiful day, a real party atmosphere. I arrived into this enormous crowd and saw this big, big stage with so many people on it. The picture that I liked from that was Bob Marley when I was trying to capture his dreadlocks, because to me, that was still something new to us as opposed to what we normally see on stage, having shot loads of pictures of people like Rory Gallagher and Phil Lynott and Christy Moore and whatever. He is in his typical denim shirt with multicolour patches sewed into it, rainbow type colours, and he's holding and gripping the microphone and moving ahead a little bit to the right, and then it's actually just shifting from right to left, and that's why the dreadlocks are flying. The dreadlocks actually take up most of the image, which was the idea. To get the picture of him with his dreadlocks required watching him for quite a while, then focusing on the microphone, then adjusting the focus slightly back so that you get him in focus, and then waiting for the time when he'd shake his head, and there's a moment when you just stop when you shake one way and you stop before you turn back again, and that's when the dreadlocks take flight. So I would have shot probably at that gig 5 rolls of film, and there would only have been one frame where that was actually caught properly. I shot the
Eric Luke there on capturing his most famous image of Bob Marley, which you can see now if you follow at CultureFilePod on Twitter. Louis Scully was the reporter. One of the biggest hits of this year's Cork Midsummer Festival also happened to have its smallest audience. But that will happen if you only allow one person at a time to see your show, which is how things worked for the aptly named Theatre for One, an ingenious box inside which short plays commissioned from the likes of Stacey Gregg and Enda Walsh were performed by one actor to an audience of one. All of this was conceived and created by our guest this time, Christine Jones. Jones is a New York-based stage designer who first had the idea of a travelling theatre all in one box, and she spoke to CultureFile's Rachel Andrews, but first Emmett Kerwin, one of the nano dramatists whose work was performed in Theatre for One.
I saw this old man tumble down an escalator, not the whole way, just the last few steps. And though he didn't seem too hurt, an ambulance was called, and myself and another woman were asked to wait with him till it arrived. This other woman being the one my ex had lived with in the last few years of his life, and who just happened to be there, just like I happened to be there.
My name is Emmett Kerwin. It's a concept that started in New York a number of years ago, and it's the idea is there is one performer, one audience member. You queue up outside, there's a specially constructed box. When I say box, it's this kind of beautiful, huge kind of photo booth where you queue up and then you go into the booth, you sit down and the door slides back and then the performer's there, and what you get is a short play usually coming in at around 5 or 6 minutes.
Taken by surprise to invent an excuse, I said okay. So we went to a nearby Nero where, of course, in the course of our conversation...
To have a story that's contained in 5 minutes, you know, the beginning, the middle, the end, it starts in one place and then has to finish in another. And, you know, all theatre is, you hope, transformative. When the audience member walks in, they will come out not transformed in a existential way or, like, a profound way. But there is a small transformation in the same way there is if you go to mass or if you go to a gig or, you know what I mean, you go in one person, you come out the other. So you're writing something where you're thinking, right, I have to do something here where they get a short story and they get in and they get out, and actually compressing that down into 5 minutes is incredibly tough.
Sure, hadn't I brought that on myself with the way I behaved both during and after what happened to his daughter, Holly, 17 at the time, who, out running one evening, collapsed.
My name is Christine Jones. There are some things that remind you of being at a typical theatre. There's lights, there's maybe sound playing. You have a moment to collect yourself, but you're in front of a panel and you don't know what's going to happen, and then when the panel opens, there's a performer. It might be a male, might be a female, and they begin to tell their story.
Something I never really enjoyed, I must say, though Holly often did, which I said, and which mention of her led to Christina saying how heavily her death...
I had been at a friend's wedding, and as part of the ceremony, they had a magician perform a magic effect. And then post-ceremony, he was moving around the reception and performing magic for individuals. He performed a magic trick for me, standing, you know, 1 foot away from me. And the effect of it was so sensual and surprising that I became electrified and obsessed with this idea of what happens when you experience something privately that you normally experience publicly. And I'd been thinking also about designing a church, but I knew nobody was going to let me build a church. So I thought, well, if I made a church for one, I could build that myself. And then all of these ideas came together into the idea of, oh, but wait a minute, what if I made a theater for one?
Then saying she shouldn't have drank so much and that she hadn't been too well lately. And maybe it was because we'd just been discussing Holly. It was on my mind, but my first thought...
There is a symbiotic relationship between the host and the booth. So once we know where we're performing, we commission the writers to write the pieces. And I think that there's some way that affects if a piece is being written for an installation in Times Square versus here in Cork versus down at the World Trade Center. We were near where that space had been. It does seep into the writing. So while it is a theater unto itself, it's often in dialogue with the place that it is in residence.
Outside on the street, we embraced, promised to see each other again. Then her taxi arrived and off she went.
There's a sense of gift-giving through this whole process and feeling like the audience member is receiving a gift. They, in turn, give their gift of their attention to the writer, and the writer has given the gift of their writing to the theater, to the performer. Everybody working on it has a sense of knowing that they're making this experience for an audience member that is free, that is unexpected, that is serendipitous. And I think that that's an extremely important part of the whole experience.
Thank you.
Theatre for One creator Christine Jones there, and you heard also from Emmett Kerwin, and they were on the streets of Cork with Rachel Andrews. Now, in honour of this station's 20th birthday, you may have heard something about that, Culturefile asked music columnist and critic Michael Durvan, someone who's been observing music in Ireland over the last two decades, to tell us about the evolution he witnessed. As you'll hear now, one thing that left a large, if unexpected, impression was the rise of Irish opera. But there are also one or two apps that play their part in the story.
The biggest change is accessibility. MP3 files, file sharing, YouTube, Apple Music, Spotify, SoundCloud. Everything and anything is now just a click away. Well, almost everything. Composers everywhere have a digital reach that was unimaginable in a pre-internet era. The music of Irish composers is more readily available around the world than ever before. In 2000, Jennifer Walsh's Os Mo Cheann, Out of My Head, an intimate, startling and slightly disturbing work for voice, violin and stones, announced a major new talent. She has gone on to invent and retrospectively compose works for an Irish avant-garde that never existed. The collective Grouphat was her sole creation, and she invited other composers in on the act in Aisteach. The books documenting these fake artists are a matter of wonder in their own right. That same year, 2000, Lyric FM took the unusual step of presenting a Gerald Barry Festival. And both Gerald and Jennifer have been part of the most surprising turnaround of the last two decades. The mainstreaming of Irish opera. The first time I tried to set up an interview with Jennifer, she was in Stuttgart working on her opera Die Taktik, Tactics. The first time I actually interviewed her was in Amsterdam, where she was in rehearsal in the Muziekgebouw for her new opera, Time, Time, Time. The Dutch premiere of Donica Dennehy and Enda Walsh's The Second Violinist took place in the same venue a short time later. Jennifer Walsh is hard to imagine unless you've seen her. She's half writer, half performer, half artist. For Groupat, there's a book, there are CDs. There was an exhibition. So she made these fictional works, invented the childhoods of the people she had created, and even did false press reviews, and did them all in the right style for whatever publication, if there was a real publication involved. So she's one of those composers who's, on one sense, the kind of thing that people would say it's totally mad, but when she hits the target, it's just amazing. Opera by Irish composers has seen an unheralded transformation. It began actually a little bit before Lyric FM with Gerald Barry's The Intelligence Park, which was seen in London and Dublin in 1990. And the transformation got fully into gear when Gerald's The Bitter Tears of Peter von Kant was produced by English National Opera in 2005. Production of this all-female opera on Rainer Werner Fassbinder's play was the first time in over a century that an opera by an Irish composer was presented by a major international house. My name is Peter von Kant. Gerald Barry is kind of unique in that he does something that shouldn't work, but does work. And a lot of that has to do with the way he sets text. It's like you took some kind of crazy machine to the text and chopped it up in bits. Bits of it go very fast, bits of it go very slow. So he kind of explodes the text. In spite of the fact of how crazy that seems, it actually works. So his opera, The Importance of Being Earnest, is very, very funny. The then director of opera in Covent Garden called it the first comic masterpiece of the 21st century. It is a seaside resort. And then he'll find you in a handbag. Gerald's operas have also been seen at the Albright Festival in Paris, Berlin, Basel, Los Angeles, New York, Nancy and Fribourg. Donica Dennehy's operas have also travelled around Europe and crossed the Atlantic. And there have been other works by Siobhan Cleary, Raymond Dean, Brian Irvine, Ian Wilson. In October, Andrew Sinnott will become the first living Irish composer to have a work on the main stage of the Wexford Festival, something that was once utterly unimaginable. The number of composers working in Ireland has grown exponentially. The financial crash was bad for funding, but it was good for enterprise. Composers began to take their fates into their own hands. The list of living Irish composers has risen to over 250, though it has to be said that most of them don't actually make their living from writing music. For the commemorations of 1916, RTE and the National Concert Hall joined forces to create Composing the Island, the biggest ever festival focusing on the work of Irish composers. In September 2016, it covered the century between 1916 and 2016, and its 28 concerts had surprises for everyone, not least the fact that two women, Ina Boyle and Rhoda Coghill, had undertaken major large-scale works in the 1920s. The Waking the Feminist movement in theatre spawned a similar concern in music, given the preponderance of all male concerts in Composing the Island. And the landscape for music by women, whether living or dead, has begun to change as a result. The National Concert Hall is running a dedicated series and has a new commissioning scheme that is only open to women. The new music groups Concord and Crash Ensemble both have female artistic directors, and Belfast's Hard Rain Ensemble is conducted by a woman. It's not just women who are benefiting from the revival and reassessment. In 2017, Opera Theatre Company presented a concert performance of the first ever Irish language opera, Robert O'Dwyer's Aetna of 1909. No one in the record industry seems to have foreseen the MP3 revolution. And 20 years ago, no one foresaw the transformations in Irish opera. I take to try and predict what the musical future will bring, except to say that we'll have a way of surprising us all.
Michael Durven there on the rise of Irish opera. And finally this weekly, Dream Cycles, a Dublin-based artist and musician who also answers to, among other things, Bitflower BB and the slightly more direct Jennifer Moore. Although she's recently released her Dream Cycles debut album, Moore began making sounds when she was studying video at NCAD and only later began to understand what she was doing as music. The new release, Mostalgia, conjures contemporary Dublin and its spaces using sleepy synthesizers and process wisps of voice, as well as, occasionally, the machinery of Dublin Port.
I started to realize that I could make my own music. It kind of was this slow realization over time where I was like, oh, I'm allowed to do this. This is okay. I used to love working with video and kind of the moving image before. I had a great technician as well who, I guess, opened up the whole area of sound to me, which I kind of found easy to enter into through being comfortable with like an editing setup or an editing kind of interface, because I did a lot of editing with video work. When that moment clicked, I guess I was in maybe second or third year when I realized, oh, I can actually just use microphones and start making anything I want to make and then just go from there. What I didn't come from any kind of musical background particularly. I never studied music. I still don't know any music theory. It wouldn't feel very authentic, I think, to kind of go straight into doing that now. But I just think curiosity and kind of following your heart with something that grabs you has been the way I've moved through all these things.
What were your first like sonic creations then?
Probably a cassette tape I made. I was also very interested in Dublin Port at the time. That piece was kind of about the machinery and the cycle of the machinery's movements throughout the port over the course of a day, a night. I grew up across from the port, so I could always hear the port at night coming across the bay, Dublin Bay. It was just something that's always stuck in my mind as being this amazing source of mystery and excitement. So I spent some time recording in the port that year, like a lot of time actually moving around the port, recording different parts of it at different times of the day and night. And I got lots of ideas for how maybe I could build music in the same way that the port was this kind of musical experience that I was having. It all seemed to click at that time where I was like, oh, I could just layer these things and sometimes these rhythms fall into place with each other and other times those rhythms fall into place with each other and these machines are actually just like big instruments and what isn't an instrument? And it was really nice to get to explore my own personal experience at the same time as new technology and new making processes. I had spent some time in the Techcrete factory, the old concrete factory in Howth. That's in a huge abandoned building. At that time, I had been thinking a lot about, you know, how these economic tides like rise and fall. And I made a sound piece about that. And I went and I recorded things there and I wrote things there. I went and just wrote when I was there. It was just very much an honest kind of personal kind of work, but also trying to use the place itself because I didn't play instruments, so I had to make other sounds using other things. It was really minimal for ages, and then I started using my voice. I started to realize that I could make my own music. It kind of was this slow realization over time where I was like, oh, I'm allowed to do this. This is okay.
that I can do this, even though I have no qualification or no guidance in any way. It reminds me in a way of like 90s euphoria. It has that really like sincere optimism, and that was really represented in music. And it's very underrepresented in music at the moment.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, I just love I love euphoric music, like loads of people. There's something very contagious about it, and I think if you grow up like a sensitive person in an abrasive world, people respond differently, but I definitely try and hold on to things that are calming and reassuring and make you soar a bit. And I mean, I love trance music for that reason, and the vocals in it and the vocals in pop music, they hold this kind of energy that I think can just enter your soul when you're listening to it. The record was in my head originally just going to be a record, but it kind of has to be also digitally released. I had no desire to do a hype thing with it. I just wanted it to be exist. And I think it's kind of sad that these days that it's hard to make things exist without commodifying them so much. It just kind of makes me sad to see art have to exist in that way and have to be communicated and translated and swapped between people in that way. There's something infinite about sound in that way. Even like with the way the clouds change and the way that the skies move, it's always so fleeting. It almost seems so futile to try and grasp it or take photos or videos or anything. But with sound, when you're re-listening to it, you are pulled straight back in again.
Dublin artist and musician Jennifer Moore there, and the reporter was Áine Gallagher. Dream Cycle's debut record, Mastalgia, is on All City Records. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more image-free beauty next Friday at 7. Till then, bye now.